got a busy schedule today, because you look at the agenda, a lot of items on there. We've got some rules that we would like to get a few of them approved, at least, so they can start working on the,
some of the base things coming up, but we'll go through our agenda, and we'll try and get as much done as possible before we have to go up to the budget section. The minutes of the last meeting, if they've been read, if I have a motion to approve them?
So moved.
I have a motion by Senator Flacco, is there a second?
Second.
Second by Senator Wardner, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Motion is approved. The 805 item is review of the guidelines for the use of legislative chambers and displays in Memorial Hall. Mr. Beringwood?
Mr. Chairman, the guidelines have been distributed to everyone before. There's been no change for the last 3 years, so, with your permission, I won't review them. Basically, the approval of the use of chambers is subject to any special legislative session that may be called or any other legislative use. And all the requests that have been presented to the committee today have been previously approved at different times in the past. There's no new type of organization. And with that, I'll go right into the requests.
Good.
Okay, there's a request from the Department of Trust Lands to use the House Chambers for oil and gas lease auctions in May, August, and November 2014. That's been previously approved in the past for similar, a similar request has been approved in the past. There's a request from the Department of Trust Lands. There's a summer conference of the Western States Land Commissioners Association. Typically, there's a roll call of states where the individual representatives from representative states give an update of what is happening on their land grant programs. There are 23 member states that are requesting use of the Senate chambers on July 21st. And we have a request from, that's not on the agenda, but it was received yesterday. No sense waiting until the last minute before the committee meets. But it was a request from the North Dakota Leadership Seminar to use the House Chambers on the afternoon of May 31st, 2014. They have a conference. The Leadership Seminar is a nonprofit organization. It has a 3-day leadership seminar for high school sophomores throughout North Dakota. They're meeting at the University of Mary and from May 30th to June 1st, and they would like to be able to use the House Chambers on the afternoon of May 31st. The committee has previously approved the North Dakota Leadership Seminar in the past. The last one that's been approved was in 2008, and because in the meantime, in 10 and 12, there were some reorganization structures and changes in personnel, so they didn't have the leadership seminar, but the committee has approved that in the past. And those are the three requests, Mr. Chairman. If that warrants approval from members, a motion would be in order.
We have a motion for approval. A motion by Representative Mosk. Is there a second? Representative Vigasov. Any further discussion?
Next roll call.
And we'll take a roll call vote.
Representatives Carlson.
Yes.
Devlin.
Yes.
Mark.
Yes.
Onstead.
Yes.
Vigasa.
Yes.
Senators Wardner.
Aye.
Flacco.
Yes.
Heckerman.
Yes.
Holmberg.
Yes.
Klein.
Aye.
Schneider.
Aye.
Motion carried, Mr. Chairman.
Next item on the agenda is consideration of offer of the North Dakota Medical Association to provide physician services during the 2015 session to the doctor of the day as they've done in the past.
Hey, Mr. Chairman, I've got a letter from Ms. Courtney Coble, who's here, but they've offered to provide Doctor of the Day services for the 2015 legislative session. They use residents from around the state to volunteer for the program and provide basic health care services on most days when the legislative assembly is in session, and are also offering the opportunity to participate in health screenings and educational wellness activities during the session. So it's an offer that the committee has traditionally accepted in the past.
No motion to accept.
So moved.
A motion by Senator Wardner, second by Representative Mock. Any discussion? That's a great service, by the way, for those of us who've ever come down with something, you need to get down there and get a little shot of meds. It's a great thing. And it never hurts to have a doctor in the facility when the session is on. We need a roll call vote on that?
That would be nice, Mr. Chairman.
All right, well, without further discussion, we'll take a vote.
Representatives Carlson?
Yes.
Devlin?
Yes.
Mock?
Yes.
Onstead?
Yes.
Vigasa?
Yes.
Senators Wardner?
Aye.
Flacco?
Yes.
Heckerman?
Yes.
Holmberg?
Yes.
Klein?
Aye.
Schneider?
Aye.
Motion carried.
Next item is a review of information regarding proposed dates for receipt of statutory required reports to standing committees. And we'll go through the list that we have here. Springer?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, there's some statutes. The first three are statutory requirements of reports to the Legislative Assembly. Usually the timeframe is set out within the first, between the first and the tenth legislative days. And the committee traditionally determines the date that those are to be given so that the arrangements can be made with the groups or the entities that are providing these reports. And this is the equivalent as the agricultural commodity promotion groups are giving report on their activities. And that traditionally is the second day the agriculture committee meets, and that would be Friday, January 9th. Agriculture commission must report to a joint committee meeting of the agriculture committees on the status of the pesticide container disposal program. Again, that's between the first and the tenth legislative days, and that's been combined with the agricultural commodity promotion groups because both agriculture committees hold a joint hearing at that time. So that's traditionally been on the second day, Friday, January 9th. And then the Commissioner of Commerce on the department's goals and objectives has to provide a report to a committee, the Legislative Assembly, and that traditionally has been the Industry, Business, and Labor Committee. The second day that committee meets is Monday, January 12th, assuming the legislature starts on Tuesday. The first day the Industry, Business, and Labor Committee meets is Wednesday, and then Monday has been the traditional time for that. Then there's the addresses. State of the State address is the first day. Usually this committee authorizes the Legislative Council staff to contact the Governor, the Chief Justice, and the Indian tribes to make the arrangements for those addresses. State of the State would be on January 6th, State of the Judiciary would be on January 7th, and Tribal-State Relationship message would be on January 8th. And if all that is acceptable to the committee, then a motion would be in order to approve all those dates.
Any discussion on any of those items? Mr. Flacco, I know that you had the Ag Committee.
It just seems, Mr. Chairman, it just always seemed a little odd that they would set them for us. I mean, I think if the committee chairs of the committee have things they want to do in terms of bill loads and things like that, you know, if we'd have gave them latitude to say do it within the first 30 days, they'd figure it out. I mean, they have to reserve the Brynhild Haugen room, but there's at least a couple committee members in here. I don't know if it matters or not, but sometimes they like the flexibility of setting their own schedule.
Mr. Chairman, just in sort of a response is the Brynhild Haugen room is reserved in the organizational session. So presumably if the committees are going to decide this, they need to decide during the organizational session when they're going to hold these joint hearings because the room starts filling up. I mean, I'm just pointing that out rather than waiting until the session starts.
These are statutory requirements,
yes,
that are in code.
Yeah.
But the dates aren't in code, that the report being received are in code, correct?
Between the first and tenth legislative days. That's in the code.
So if we left it just that it was in the first and tenth legislative day and let the chairman set it, is that a problem? Or?
No, I don't care.
Well, I don't either, because I know a lot of times early in the session we're trying to fill things because we don't have enough bills to really get everybody rolling, and we're trying to have something for those committees to work on, especially in the B committee. Seems to have more because we eat up the rest of the week on the A's with all the pomp and circumstance, but doesn't make really any difference to me. But Senator Flacco?
I'm not on that committee anymore, so I care less, but I mean, we're scheduling some things already too, so, and I think, you know, you could probably run those three presentations concurrently. Under the 8:15 item. That would be a joke, Mr. Chairman.
He's reading a different place to a book than I am here. So what are the wishes of the committee here? Obviously the three dates for the secretary, for the governor, for the judiciary, and the tribes are pretty well set. That's the way they've been. That works fine.
Well, Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
You know, Mr. Chairman, there's been some discussion as, you know, as we fill in all those days and go right to the bitter end, that is there any way that we could somewhat compress that? Do we need to spend an afternoon? Because basically that's what it's going to take for both the judiciary and the tribes. Is there any way, has there ever been any discussion as to whether we could I don't know, somewhat streamline that. And I think there's people in the audience that would comment.
We will take comment.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Representative Blair Harrison from District 44 in Fargo. And this is something I'd had some discussions with some folks, especially in states where the governor gives his State of the State address, usually in prime time, so that it gets wider coverage. People are home in the evenings to watch it. It just seems to me, maybe not this time, but perhaps going forward, we look at somehow, you know, by saving a legislative day, by maybe moving two of these to one day, perhaps doing the state of the relationship in the morning and the judiciary in the afternoon, or vice versa. I suppose you could do them all in one day and then have the governor that evening, or find some way to do that. And as you said just a moment ago, Mr. Chairman, there aren't a lot of bills coming forward that early part of the session, but there are some things that the A committees probably would work on, and it might be a way of just saving a little bit of time towards the end, possibly. So that's my only comment. I just think maybe going forward it would be something to take a look at. Happy to answer any questions.
Many members, we need to do something with this. Thoughts? Representative Onstad, I see the wheels grinding over there.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I just think for now a lot of that stuff is set in stone. It's worth the discussion later on, but I just think that we should just keep it the way it is right now.
Was that a motion?
Senator Wagner?
Well, the only comment I have is that if we would do that, then we've got to make sure that something's happening. Because when we start in early in the session, Wednesday, the A committees are organizing and they hear a couple of bills, but you got to have bills then. On the second day, let's say we did all that on, let's see, normally we do that, the governor is on Tuesday, right?
Yes.
And then we do this on Wednesday. Well, then when you get to Thursday, well, you better make sure we have enough bills to keep those B committees going to have a session in the morning and the afternoon. We got to have something to fill that spot, or it's just nothing happens. So, you know, I guess I think it's worth considering. I happen to agree with Representative Onstad. For now, I'll just leave it, but something that we should think about as we go through this next session, and then if we feel that there's a way we can do it, I'm okay with it.
Well, what I'm going to do as the chair, I'm going to review that as a motion to accept in a second.
All right.
Any further discussion? We'll take the vote.
Representative Carlson.
Yes.
Devlin.
Aye.
Mock.
Yes.
Onstad.
Yes.
Nigasup.
Yes.
Senator Wardner.
Aye.
Flacco.
No.
Heckerman.
Yes.
Holmberg.
Aye.
Klein.
Aye.
A week, all right. Okay. Schneider. Motion carries, Mr. Chairman.
For a minute, I thought Representative Delzer was sitting over there. All right, we have that, and I think that's the point to discuss tonight. Just a little more flexibility there, but I'm not sure it makes a great big difference. I do have. You know, the governor's never once requested that we have an evening State of the State. A lot of states do, because then they can get the statewide TV coverage and stuff, but it's never been asked for. And he came to us and said, if you do it in the evening, then that'd be a consideration you want to make, but otherwise we're going to keep our schedule the same. All right, before we move on, you just have to remind me, Mr. Buringrud, about the dates of the Legislative Council report and the dates of the opening of the session, just so I don't miss those things.
Mr. Chairman, the Legislative Management Committee is November 12th and 13th. I think it's Wednesday and Thursday.
Okay.
It's a day and a half.
Opening of session?
The regular session would be January 6th, Tuesday, January 6th. The organizational session.
First Monday.
Yeah, it's Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, the first 3 days.
Those dates.
Yeah, I'll have it here in a second.
One, two, three.
Yeah,
six.
First, second, and third, Mr. Chairman. Yep.
First, second, and third?
That's correct.
just good reference for everybody to have those dates plugged in as they go forward. All right, the next is a presentation by the staff on proposed rules amendments relating to, and there are House rules and Senate rules here. Mr. Beringer, if I remember correctly, we had the House members vote on the House rules and the Senate members, and then we all voted on the joint ones. Is that how we do it?
We can do it any way you want. Usually, except for the first two rules, the amendments deal with House and Senate rules.
Yeah, Senator Wardner? I mean, I honestly don't feel that I need to get in and be voting on Senate rules.
It does help, Mr. Chairman, if the rules parallel one another. Just when you have members from one house jumping over to the other house, they don't get surprised.
Well, if you would denote that, if that happens to be the case, I don't believe that's the case
no.
here.
No.
And if that's not the case, then I think we'll have the House guys vote on the House rules and the Senate, unless they're the same rule in both chambers.
Right.
So do we match them up? All right, we'll go forward to the first one, Rule 202. And these are in order in your books.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, I probably should have clarified that we normally don't take roll call votes on the initial approval of rules. That's done at the end of the interim when you approve all the rules amendments and ask the report be drafted and any bill drafts. It's just one motion or else we'll be here for a long period of time.
Okay. So we take voice votes is what you're saying?
Yeah.
Voice votes, fine.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, to allay any fears here, these aren't my ideas. Okay, because some people think that I'm sitting there thinking of rules changes just to cause chaos, because chaos is good if you're an attorney, but it's not the case. The comments, if you've looked at these rules, the comments describe who proposed the suggestion and had the question, and this is an answer to that. Not necessarily isn't the only answer, but so we start. And the first one is the House Rule 202. This was to allow the Speaker to appoint a member to preside when the Speaker leaves the chair. It was proposed a question from Speaker Bill Devlin during the session. Why is this a limit on the Speaker's ability? The procedure has been to appoint the immediately preceding Speaker. So this would allow the Speaker to do that.
Representative Devlin?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. When a new Speaker goes to out of state for Speaker training and so on, certainly in my case, I appointed the former Speaker, but I just don't see any need for that particular rule. It's always covered if the Speaker's going to be gone. If it was abused, the members would change that in a hurry themselves. So I just don't see a need for that, having to get a leave of the House before you went to a training session or something for 2 or 3 days. So that's why I propose that we change it.
House members, any objection to that? I have none.
Is there a motion to approve?
We need a motion for that.
I'll move it.
Is there a second? We have a second by Representative Onstead. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay.
Mr. Chairman, the next one is a result of a House action during the session when you increased the number of sponsors of bills that you could have in the House. It was pointed out by Senator Hogue that this would mean that the Senate didn't have to accept any House bills that had more than six sponsors on them. And we informally said, don't raise the issue. The House might get upset on it. So this amendment allows the Senate to accept House bills that have more than six sponsors.
Senator Wardner?
Oh, we're okay with that. Is that what you're at?
We wanted to make sure that you accept the bills we send over if we have more than three House sponsors on it. That's basically what it is.
Well, Mr. Chairman, we did last time, and we would we put it in rule, we will accept.
Yeah, I would hope that the quality of the bill meant more than all the names listed on it, but that's good. Any discussion, Senators? Take a motion to approve. Well, I've never heard him so quiet.
Oh, I so moved.
All right, there's a motion. Is there a second? Senator Flacco. Second. He wants two sponsors. I know what you mean. Any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, I consider those two the easy rules amendments. if the committee doesn't take any action on the amendment, that doesn't mean it dies. It just stays in existence until you end this interim, whether you approve it or not.
Okay.
The next one is House Senate House Rules 317, and this was, as the comment says, it was a question by Representative Kretschmar as to whether a motion to refer or refer to committee should be a non-debatable motion. This rules amendment would include these, the refer, re-refer to a committee within the list of non-debatable motions. Without any discussion, it'll go on.
Well, any discussion on that?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, sir.
I don't know if it's necessary to add this item as a non-debatable motion. There's times when the debate is going and however it looks to be, then refer it to committee at that point. And to go right in the middle of a discussion, I think, is wrong. That's why we have the discussions. And so I think, I don't see the necessity to make this a non-debatable motion.
Anybody make that motion? Anybody from the floor?
Refer.
Yeah. Any other comments? Senator Holmberg. No, Representative Mock.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And maybe this is a question for Jay or the chair, I'm not sure. But would that, in effect, limit or truncate debate if a motion were to be made that that a motion or that a bill be re-referred or referred to a committee?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mock, I don't think that would stop the debate. There would be no debate on the motion itself.
Right. What would if that motion would be made in while a question is being debated on the floor of the House, and then someone would arise, a member would arise, and to re-refer it back to committee, would that in effect truncate or limit the debate on that question? Because my concern is that in Mason's, that any motion that would limit or truncate debate must be a debatable motion. So I'm just kind of wondering how those two would gel if this were to be included in our rules. Okay.
Well, you have to take a vote on that motion anyway.
Yes.
So you can, whether it's debatable or non-debatable, just extending the discussion on whatever it was, but you're going to take a vote on it either way, no matter how it's the rule states. It's just you're going to go right to the vote.
Mr. Chairman, to bring that motion forward, you're not even allowing the person to ask the question, what's the purpose or what's the thoughts behind it? And so that kind of, there in fact limits the debate, and why are we moving forward with to re-refer that? And it should be, if you have the question to ask why, you're not able to ask that question, but it's a non-debatable motion.
That's right.
Yeah. Well, I don't have any trouble with that. Senator Holmberg.
Well, you could have a scenario where you're having a debate and the someone makes a motion to refer to committee, and this would include either the chairman of the committee or the majority minority leader, just like saying, you know, we don't like this, the committee's already headed for 2 weeks. So I think that might create a stumbling block from the standpoint of the leaders too, and the chairman of the committee, who might want to weigh in and say, you know, we studied it for a month.
Senator Snyder, any comments?
I got to represent the English chairman. The committee doesn't want to totally refer because we don't have a general meeting to that.
I don't know about in the Senate, but in the House, we very seldom re-refer bills. I mean, sometimes we change committees because we get them in the wrong place, but very seldom do we re-refer unless we find a drastic mistake in a bill that they didn't catch and somebody on the floor catches it and we send it back down and fix it. Or, very seldom do we do it. So I don't have any trouble with leaving the rule the way it is myself, because debate is what we're here for. So I would say that...
go on to the next rule.
Go on to the next one. We do not have to take action on this, but I think the general consensus is there's nothing wrong with it the way it is.
Mr. Chairman, the next one is a proposed amendment to Senate House Rules 507.1. This would require a hearing on every bill or resolution referred to the committee, As pointed out by Representative Kretschmar, the common belief is that there's a hearing required on every bill or resolution referred to committee. That's not the case. Every bill or resolution has to be referred to committee, but there's no rule requirement that there's a, that the committee hold a hearing. Presumably, it's the fear of embarrassment on the floor if a bill gets pulled back from committee. The first question without a hearing would be, why didn't you hold a hearing on the bill on it? So this puts in the rules that you have to have a hearing on every bill or resolution before the appropriate deadline. And then the comment lists the various deadlines for reporting bills out of committee.
You could still withdraw a bill and not have a hearing.
Correct. Well, no. Well, it's scheduled for a hearing.
But if it's scheduled, it's got to have it. You can't not have it. That's all this rule says, correct? I'm trying to figure
yes.
out
without,
how
without
it's different than what we're doing it today.
Without amendment, this bill would not allow you to withdraw. This rule would not allow you to withdraw a bill until it's heard in committee. Because it says it has to be heard.
So, for example, Dwayne McCray puts in a bill that says we got to cover every deer carcass after we shoot them. And he finds out that there's a whole lot of people mad about that. So he calls them to the floor and says, please withdraw my bill. You're telling me we could not withdraw that bill.
Unless this rule, unless this rule's amendment is amendment. Is amended
yeah.
to allow unless the bill or resolution is withdrawn. I mean, it's a simple fix,
yeah.
but without that fix, you need to have a hearing on the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Jay, is it possible, I mean, can we, with the, with our understanding, if we were to approve that rule with that fix, can we approve this, this rule change today, or would you want to redraft it and bring it back to another meeting?
I prefer to have it redrafted okay. and bring it back to another meeting.
I think that I could live with it with that other.
I could do it.
Yeah, the end of it, but I'm not so sure I'd like it the way it is here.
Well,
I know Representative Gray would have not liked it.
Okay, that'll be done.
All right, next one on the list.
The next one is a proposed amendment to Senate and House Rules 306. This concerns rules of debate. The question was, Representative Delzer called up and he said, boy, under the rule, does that mean if I've designated a carrier of the bill, I'm subject to the limits on debate? And I said, no. And this makes sure that the chairman of the committee is not, by designating a carrier of the bill, does not give up the exemption from the limitation on speaking twice on the question. I think what it's intended to do is clarify the issue. The rule doesn't apply to majority and minority leaders and the chairman of the committee, nor to a carrier of the bill. The spokesman designated by the chairman is has been commonly understood as the carrier.
I don't see any trouble with that.
Seems to be a matter of grammar.
Yeah.
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 Move to approve.
Second.
We have a motion that this one go forward. Any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the next one is proposed creation of Senate and House Rules 339.1. This was a question for Representative Kretschmar. Should the vote on resolutions be clarified? Some are done by voice, some are done by verification, some are recorded roll call vote. So what this rule does is specify, basically, resolutions are approved by a voice vote, unless it's in Senate Rule 340, meaning it calls for the expenditure of funds or a constitutional amendment, or under Senate Rule 320, or House Rule 320, and that is one-sixth of the members present request a recorded roll call vote, which is a constitutional provision on it. So basically, if it's a constitutional amendment, if it calls for the expenditure of money, or it's a roll call vote's been requested, you approve resolutions by a voice vote.
Questions, thoughts?
I'll move it. I mean,
I don't have a couple with that.
Yeah.
Most of the time we're doing it that way anyway.
Yeah.
Right. All right, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Okay. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the next proposal is for Senate and House Rules 319, and that is to provide for, relates to division of a question. The question from Representative Kretschmar is, should the request to be made before the matter is being debated on the floor, or as we have done, to allow a division during floor debate? Now, technically, floor debate begins when the question appears up on the roll call board. And that's when floor debate begins. So that's why you have this first or second member, some options here. Request to divide the question must be made before the first member has spoken. That means once the question is put before you, before the carrier or anybody, you have to make the question divide. The second, using the second member, is after the carrier explains it, the request to divide has to be made before anybody else speaks. I mean, you can put in third or fourth or fifth, but this is just something to get it before the committee.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Senator Holmberg.
There are times that the members might not be inclined to have a division until the measure gets moving along and all of a sudden finds that you as a member really would like to be able to vote separately on. So I think particularly if you're talking about carrying the bill and then, if you don't make a decision to divide it, you're stuck with the entire question rather than the division. But I can't recall a problem that has arisen. In the Senate under the current rule, I don't know how to...
Maybe you know something we don't.
No, I know the issue came up in the House.
It came up in the House, and it was divided about halfway through, and it was a circus. Because we don't amend on the floor like you guys do, so for us that's like a whole other procedure, because here's what we were going to vote on, but now we're going to vote on two separate things, and really, the debate and everything was kind of confusing. You may already be doing it that way in the Senate. But I don't know that it's right to say after the first person speaks, so I don't know if that's the right language for that. Senator Flackel?
Mr. Chairman, I would not support this because I think, as Senator Holmberg said, sometimes you get into debate and you realize out of the 43 sections, there's this one that seems to be hanging things up that's really not that central to the bill. And you realize that and you said, well, we'll divide that one issue out and vote on Division A and Division B and let B die. Because the other option then would be sending it back down to committee, which just expands the process and isn't really serving the purpose, because most of those votes are often, once you get into that, they're pretty straightforward and kind of help the bill out.
Oh, the best thing for us is if we're always in advance in the House, if we know we're going to divide the question, then everybody can have the proper information in their hand. And when we didn't have it, it was a real concern, but I'm not sure saying that after the first person speaks is the right way to do it. Is that the right time to divide it or not? I don't think you can clarify that.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Senator Holmberg.
It has not been a problem at all in the Senate. Is there any reason why, if the House wants to hone this a little better and have the rule, because you don't have the experience of the amending, you can have that as House Rule 319, does it have to be identical to Senate Rule 319?
Oh, Mr. Chairman, Senator Holmberg, no. I mean, there are distinctions between the rules, which I, of course, I can't immediately think of one. the House and the Senate can handle divisional questions differently.
I think we should postpone this and look at it from the House perspective and see if there's anything we can do. Representative Mock, any thought on that?
Well, if we're not going to take it up today, I don't know that I have a whole lot to add. I am just concerned, hearing from the Senate, and there was that one instance, and I think that was caught everybody off guard, but in the end, sound leadership was able to kind of, wade through the muck and get us, navigate us to the end. And I'm more concerned that, much to Senator Flackel's point, that if something is arisen, by implementing a rule that prohibits us from dividing a question after debate has begun, after one or two speakers, our hands are tied. And so, right now, I wouldn't support a change. I would be interested in seeing if there's any other way of further clarifying and preventing a situation that we had last session, but I don't know that there's a rule necessarily that can fix what had happened. I think it's more a matter of educating our members and making sure they know how the process works.
we divide many things. We're just doing it in advance.
Right.
Usually coming out of committee, we know what we want to divide. So let's put that one on the shelf.
Mr. Chairman, this may be one other thing procedurally. If I'm working the board and I see Bigasaw is the carrier, has his light on because he's the carrier, Carlson has his light on, and Thorson has his light on because he wants to divide the question, I'm not going to Thorson. Because, one, I don't know. I mean, and protocol would dictate that you go to the other two first.
Sometimes. Sometimes. All right, next.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, as the next rules amendment, even though it's called an amendment, there's no change in the rule. It's brought to you for discussion purposes, and that's Senate and House Rules 321. It's in response to a question concerning presence in the Senate. A member had left the chamber presumably to avoid voting on a measure, and the Senate and House rules require every member who is present before the vote is announced from the chair shall vote unless the Senate or House excuses the member. And present is defined as physically in the chamber. And I talked to the Lieutenant Governor after this issue happened. He said he interprets Senate Rule 321 to mean that if a member is present at initial roll call, that member is present, and regardless of any temporary absence, whether it's restroom or anything else, and must vote, even if he has to hold the key open. And I just present this for your information. I don't know how to address it, other than maybe the way the Senate did. I think the senators remember the situation.
Already, there is already a rule that says if you're in the chamber, you have to vote, correct?
Yeah, I think the senator left the chamber.
But I mean, there is a rule that says
yes,
that if you are in the chamber and if they're not voting, the speaker's supposed to call them out on our side to cast their ballot, to cast their vote. But
Mr. Chairman, but this is essentially a, you know, complete rewrite of it. It essentially, you were there for the vote, ran up to the doctor or whatever, we'd hold the key open until you came back. You know, under the present situation, the speaker checks if they're in the chair, if they haven't voted, calls out their name in case they're in the back of the chamber or whatever. But if they've left the chamber, essentially what you're asking for here is that the vote not be closed until that member comes back, is the way I understood it. And that, I don't think that's what we want to do.
Mr. Chairman, no, there's no change to this. I just pointed out what the Lieutenant Governor
Saying that the present means you have to vote, and is that our interpretation, basically?
Well, I'm...
Senator, you got half on your side, Senators. Let's hear from you guys. Senator Schneider.
To be fair, this has happened in the past on several occasions.
Oh, yeah.
I'm just a little confused as to what we're being asked to do here. There's no amendments. The presiding officer of the Senate has an interpretation. What are we being asked to do?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm not asking you to do anything on this. I present the rule of amendments because to point out that these are the questions that were raised, they were brought to me, and here's the applicable rule. What do you want to do? I don't have any suggestion on handling this.
I guess the question would be, Senator Schneider, if you're if the vote happens to be 25-23 or 24-23, whatever happens to be in your chamber, and you know that, and one member leaves, so now it's 22 or your side, or it's a tie, and you know that the guy was on your side and he was present but he went to the bathroom, what would you request his rule to be interpreted as? Would you request it because he's present, he had to get back and vote because then you win? Or what would you do?
I'd love to be in that position.
Well, that's why I was making it up.
But I think, you know, I really remember the situation well, and the member was graciously excused by the Senate, and I think that Senate failed to do it. I don't have a problem with the current rule. I don't have a problem with the interpretation.
I just want to make sure that if that arises, we've had this discussion, and vote's not there, it's not there. Senator Warner?
Well, just to comment about that, and I think maybe over the years we became lax. People would go to the restroom, and then we'd vote, and they didn't get recorded. They just weren't there. We didn't. This brought it to our attention that we needed to be a little more vigilant of that, and so from there on, and that was a learning lesson for all of us, and myself included. And so after that, we said, if you're in the chambers and the bathroom is part of the chambers, you need to vote.
I know it gets pretty crowded in the men's room in the house sometimes.
Okay.
So we're just going to pass on that interpretation there.
Okay, the last one, Mr. Chairman, is, at least the last one today, is the proposed amendments to Senate House Rules 335 and Joint Rule 601. And this was in response to a question from Representative Kretschmar. Should Senate bills be re-engrossed after the House adopts amendments to the bill? This was not done during 2013, and it did cause some confusion. And to give you a little background on this, the official version of a bill is, like, let's just use House. So I don't have to say House, Senate. House bill gets amended in the House, it's an engrossed bill. Goes over to the Senate, gets amended, it's an engrossed House bill with Senate amendments. It comes back. The official version is not that version. The official version is the House engrossed bill. That's the official version of the bill. And there's some confusion caused because people go to conference committee and they start amending the version that they see that's marked up on the computers. Computers are a bane because it's given them too much information to legislators sometimes on it. I say that somewhat facetiously, but because what you had in the past was you just had the House bill and you had the Senate, the engrossed House bill with the Senate amendments attached. And that's what the conference committee is supposed to be working with. And what's happened is people will sit there and look on the computers and they'll see the version of the bill that has the Senate amendments included into it. It's a marked up version of the bill. And they start talking about amending that bill on it, and that's not what you amend. And it causes some problems because we get amendments in our office and it's going, well, they didn't even amend the right bill. What's wrong with these people on it? So that's some confusion there on it. So, but the Senate can, or the House, they can order a bill from the other chamber to be engrossed. And that happened sometimes in the past. And when that happened, then the bill came back on a different colored paper. If it was a House bill, it came back and it was blue. Senate bill came back and it was yellow. That was not done too often. It was done mainly if there were if it's a three-page bill with seven pages of amendments on it. It was too confusing to try to fit all everything in, so maybe the Senate would order it to be re-engrossed on it. Very seldom that was done. And the reasons for that, if you look at the comments, this can be done, but it's going to change the procedures and the way you operate. If you look at the comments, if the Senate engrosses the House bill, it comes back to the House. There's no amendments to the House for the House to concur in. It's either a straight up or down vote on the bill as it passed the Senate on it. So the amendments would still be there. So it'd be up to the chairman of the standing committee, if that's the one who decides in the House, to look at those amendments to see whether you should enact the bill, approve the bill as passed. If not, then you can request the conference committee. If it goes to conference committee, the bill in conference committee would be the marked up bill. You wouldn't have amendments. Now there's good and bad about that. And the one thing is, I assume you are aware of this because some members are very vocal about that when they ask us to do amendments. You take away the we win, you lose argument in conference committees. Because some people come to our office and they want draft amendments that the other house exceeds to our amendments. Or the other house recedes from its amendments because that way we can win. Okay? So you have that type of winning atmosphere. And, there are some legislators that want us to draft amendments that way, and sometimes it's impossible on it. The other aspect is, if you do this and you take that factor out of the equation for conference committees, you basically open up the conference committee to a free conference, because what they have before them is the bill. They don't have just the amendments, they have the bill on it. So they can go off and do something other than just working on the amendments. Under the rules, they're supposed to be limited to what the differences are between the houses, the amendments. I just ask you for your consideration, how often is that violated anyway on it? Okay? So that's what this rules change would do.
Well, let me ask this then, Mr. Chairman. If, for example, the House had a bill, Senate amended it, so the House is the engrossed bill. Is that right?
Okay, if the House has a bill, if the House doesn't amend it, it never becomes an engrossed bill.
Okay, let's say they amend it and it's an engrossed bill.
It's an engrossed bill, it goes to the Senate.
And the Senate amends it. So now it comes to conference committee and they decide to accept the Senate amendments and further amend. Can you do that?
Now? Yes.
Yes, yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, and that's the way it would read.
No, you can do that right now.
Yeah.
What would happen if this rule change were adopted? Rather than that, it would come out of conference committee just like a regular committee report. It would come out of the conference committee saying, we recommend approval of this bill as amended, and would just come out with amendments.
Okay. Yes, Senator Holbert.
Under the current situation, though, at least the body, the people in the conference committee and the body are aware of the fact that these were the amendments and these were the changes, whereas if you had re-engrossed the bill, the body wouldn't know necessarily if the conference committee had just gone off the deep end or had confined itself to what were truly the differences between the House and the Senate. In the current system, at least you know if they go rogue, and sometimes it happens, not on my conference committee, but sometimes it happens. But at least the body is aware under the current system. Under this system, they might not be aware.
I'm not arguing either way, but the members are going to be aware of it because you have the amendments in the computer. So you'll know what the amendments are in the Senate. The aspect as to when they amend the bill that's in conference committee, yes, it's going to be hard to compare the amendments to that second House amended engrossed bill to the original amendments. But I don't know how easy it is to do that now, really. And I don't know how many members look at amendments from both and try to figure out what the differences are, because you don't really see them that easily.
Maybe one of our IT guys can help us here, but aren't those, no matter what, don't we have those amendments highlighted in those bills so when we're looking at them we can tell what they are? No matter what version it is, if we engross it or not engross it, don't we have them highlighted so we can see the changes? The marked up version is there no matter what, right?
Right. And that's what's causing some confusion by members, because they think the marked up version is the official version, and it's not.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Basically, when you go to conference committee, you're only supposed to discuss the differences between the House and the Senate versions. That portion of that. And many times it happens that what we're saying goes back to one of the two originals where it started at, and it actually adds more or less than what the conference committee was really intended to do. And so my question is, with this passage, does it reflect more that the two conference committees are just going to discuss the differences and not allow, like some of the things that happened in the past where almost the whole intent of the bill got changed in conference committee? And then it came to that and says, you know, there should have been a hearing on this because, I mean, a major hearing on it because the intent really changed on the whole bill. And so the question is, with passage of this, does it take us, moves us forward so we really just discuss the differences? Or is this going to still allow that open forum a little bit?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Onstead, this would weaken the argument that the conference committee has gone beyond the rule in, gone beyond the limitation of discussing the amendments. Because what you're doing is you're sending the bill to the conference committee. I mean, you're sending the bill to the conference committee, but right now they're supposed to be limited to the amendments.
Well, when it's re-engrossed, you're saying they can discuss anything in the bill. There's no amendments.
That would be an easier argument to make.
I see. Well, then I don't think that's necessarily a great idea. You've been here for a while. I don't mind the way we're doing it because you can pick out the differences, and that's what you're working on. Any other thoughts? Anybody want to move this forward? I don't see the problem. I think we're chasing our tail here, but... Okay.
That completes the rules.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Senator Holman.
I have to ask the, there's a, an idea of a potential rule change for a Senate rule that it would be nice to have drafted so that the committee can look at it. And what it is, has to do with bill introduction deadlines. As you know, the Senate has an extra week of time with which they can introduce bills. And I would like the committee and the Senate members to consider a rule that would continue the same additional week of introducing bills, but provide that the deadline that occurs, you know, when you have three bills left, you know, and you have that extra week, that bills that have an appropriation must be introduced prior to that last week. Because what happens is B committees and A committees end up getting bills that are thrown in on the last possible day. They've already scheduled their next week, and the bills have to end up going to Appropriations Committee. So if we could take a look at what that rule change would be, it would require that any bill with appropriations must be introduced prior to that three-bill deadline.
We'd like to have that drafted up to
the
committee to discuss. Okay. We can do that. Anything else regarding rules? If not, we'll move on with the agenda. The 9 o'clock presentation by the council staff on a memorandum called Bill Analysis Pilot Project and some background information. I'm not sure who's going to give that. You're going to give it?
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, there's a memorandum, Bill Analysis Pilot Project, in your binders on it. This came about because there was a request during the last session to consider a limited bill analysis report pilot project, and it was put in as a legislative intent statement to the appropriation bill that this committee consider implementing a pilot project for bill analyses. And Representative Thorson was the mover of this. And the comments were, it was something the state of Washington does, Florida does it gives a brief synopsis, it would be helpful to legislators. Senator Holmberg's comments in the conference committee was, 30 years ago we had analysis on yellow sheets, no more than one sheet, they were a recap of what you're talking about, and they faded away 20 some years ago. So the memorandum, it goes through the introduction of what we used to do for legislative council bill summaries. And the bottom of the page, or the first page, talks about it. In the 70s, we did bill analyses, and basically it was a yellow sheet of paper. It had started out it was the bill number, generally this bill, and then it was about one or two sentences, okay? And it was done, there used to be a contract enroller and engrosser who was hired by the House and the Senate, and he hired four enrolling and engrossing clerks, and they did all the enrolling and engrossing of bills. They type here late at night. When the bills were coming out of committee, he would send the word down to us. He would send a copy of the bill and a copy of the amendment, send it down to the Legislative Council office, and this is what's going to be coming out of committee tomorrow. We need to do the bill analyses. So we would do those that evening, probably from about 5 to 10 that night on it. And that was the way it was proceeding through the 70s. And then the legislative internship program started in the 70s, and by the time the 80s rolled around, it was primarily law students. And what the internship program started out as, they did research for committee chairman on it. Well, as we went to the computerized bill drafting system, we kind of converted their responsibilities from research to preparing amendments. And because of the workload and the drain on the legislative council staff of doing bill summaries, we had them do bill summaries on it. And then we saw the bill summaries that afternoon because they knew what bills were going to be reported out of committee, so they did the bill summaries for them. So then we'd get the bill summaries in. We'd probably get about 50 bill summaries in from all the committees that would come in. And I would distribute those to the attorneys who had those portfolios. And that would happen between about 3:30 to 9 o'clock that night we were doing them. And let's just be kind to interns their students. And their bill summaries reflect their testimony rather than the bill. So when we saw them, we looked at them, we say, this is not adequate on it. So we'd end up rewriting them. So that's why we were here till still 9 o'clock at night. And we were also doing amendments for legislators. And frankly, on a prioritization list, amendments for legislators take priority over bill summaries. I mean, we're not stupid up there on it. So what happened is the bill summaries were turning into, we would look at them, we would just rewrite the title. Generally, this bill relates to offenses for driving while intoxicated. That would be a bill summary for the DUI bill in the last session. Like it or not, that's what you were going to get on the floor. So in the 90s, as was pointed out, 91, 92 interim, this committee, the predecessor of the Legislative Management Committee, which was LPNA, looked at this, looked at the staff that was taken and said, we're not really getting any value for these bill summaries, because if someone relies on a bill summary to vote on the bill, they're relying on the wrong thing on it. So they eliminated the bill summaries, which took a big drain off our office that night. So the bill summaries went away starting with the 93 session. We never had it. Never had them anymore. That's the background of bill summaries. All it basically turned into rehash of the title because we didn't have time to do anything else. And that's just fact of life on it. We looked at the memorandum lists types of bill analyses done in other states. It points out from Arizona all the way through Wisconsin, sometimes these bill analyses are called bill summaries. There is a difference between a bill summary and a bill analysis. There's a difference on it. They're prepared at different stages, either by the drafter, when it's introduced, when it's scheduled for a hearing before the committee, after the committee hearing, when it's passed by one house, when it's enrolled. Different stages of the process, states determine when a bill summary or analysis should be prepared. And that's described on page 2 on this. On it. We look at the bill analysis contents. Well, all this just gives background. Now we're getting into the substance. Bill analysis contents. If you look at bill analyses in other states, there's at least a fiscal analysis. And we have that right now with the fiscal note process on it, to a degree on it. Because the fiscal notes required under the rules provide that, for example, appropriated state agencies asked, if a fiscal note request is made, if there's an effect of $5,000 or more on the revenues, expenditures, or fiscal liability of the state. That's the purpose of a fiscal note. $5,000 or more on the revenues, expenditures, or fiscal liability of the state. Same thing applies to political subdivisions. But usually there's no information on political subdivisions, so it comes back saying no information is available for fiscal notes. We point out that a fiscal note is not a fiscal analysis. For example, let me give examples. Bills requiring employers to pay at least a minimum wage or to increase the minimum wage. There's a fiscal analysis. I mean, there's a fiscal impact of that, but it doesn't fit within a fiscal note on it. Or increasing or reducing requirements for occupational licensing. There's an impact on that in the economy of the state. So I'm just pointing out the examples of a fiscal analysis that we need to address that as opposed to impacting an agency, state agency. So there's the fiscal analysis part that other agencies, we'll look at what Washington does. They go into that, and you'll see why they're able to do that. But then there's the legal analysis. Legal analysis could be done by the attorneys and the staff, and that's basically how is the current law changed. Hopefully you can easily see that by the underscore and overstrike on it. But we point out that under a legal analysis, you need to look at constitutional analysis on a bill on it. And on the bottom of page 3, we talk about constitutional issues on it. Just asking the legal staff to identify bills in the last session, there's a substantial list, let's put it that way, of bills that have constitutional issues ranging from possible to probable to definitely for constitutional issues. The question there to ask is, would that be seen as something that wanted to be put into a public record before you vote on a bill on it? And the public record stays that way. When we point out some cases where there have been constitutional issues, some constitutional issues are easy to see. I mean, others are hidden. There's requirements for using different funds in the Constitution that maybe the legislature uses proceeds for a different way on it, and that would be coming out publicly on that. Nor do we, did our analysis look at budget section approval requirements. Anything that requires budget section approval is a constitutional issue. I mean, we have an Attorney General's opinion saying, stating that with respect to the budget section approval of the penitentiary, that was, he said that was probably unconstitutional because you're violating separation of powers. And this would be, again, brought out to the public every time you see something like that in the bill. Legislative intent. Some states will say, well, the bill analysis isn't part of the legislative intent. You can't, the courts can't look at legislative, they can't look at a bill analysis to determine what was meant by the bill. And that's nice. We have a statute that says source notes can't, in determining interpretation or intent of the legislature, if it's ambiguous, there are statutory attempts as to what the court may use, and we have a section that says no source note may be deemed a declaration as to the effect of any law. That's nice. That's not going to stop the court from looking at it. And I give you the case where the court did that, looked up the source note and said, the source note's there. We know where the background of this bill came from. We don't, the court didn't say it, but they just ignored the statute saying, don't look at this on it. So, again, a bill analysis would probably be used by a court to decide what the legislative intended, legislature intended when they passed this bill on it. Then we go into what Washington, because Washington State was used, we described the bill analysis preparation in the Washington State Legislature. And I want to just describe what the Washington the staff on it. And the Washington State Legislature has 49 senators, 98 House members, meets for 105 days in odd-numbered years, the budget year, and 60 days in even-numbered years. And they have special sessions. They, in 2013, they met for 105 days from January to April, then they were in special session for 30 days, May to June, and then in special session in 18 days in June, and in special session 3 days in November. Basically, what they do is they have their session, they have bills introduced and passed, their committees continue on, and they still hold hearings on the bills. On some bills, they decide how these bills are being implemented, then they come back in special session again for maybe 30 days. They have bills introduced again, they keep on doing this, then they come back maybe for 13 days in September, and they come back for 3 days to take care of bills that haven't been taken care of yet on it. They have two offices. They have the Legislative Office of Program Research, that's the House office. It's a nonpartisan agency that provides year-round staff to their 19 standing committees. This is just the House. The agency has 69 FTEs. Out of the FTEs, they have 55 policy people. That includes attorneys and master's degree holding analysts and fiscal staff members and 14 staff members on it. Their legislative assistants would be equivalent to what we refer to as committee clerks. They take the minutes, they handle the technology during the committee meeting. At least every committee in Washington has an attorney and a policy analyst, and then we in the House. And then the staffing for a particular committee varies. And I'll give you the Judiciary Committee has three attorneys and one legislative assistant. And any members of the House Appropriations Committee would like this. They have 15 staff. They have two staff coordinators, and 10 fiscal analysts, and three attorneys for their House Appropriations Committee on it. The Senate is somewhat similar. They have 59 full-time staff, 25 attorneys, 20 research and fiscal analysts, or budget coordinators, and 14 administrative assistants. Again, think of committee clerks on it. And they hire temporary assistants during the session. And staffing for a particular committee varies depending on workload. The Senate Transportation Committee has two attorneys and three fiscal analysts and a legislative assistant on it, and a budget coordinator and a committee assistant. And the Senate Ways and Means, which is the Appropriations Committee, has 16 staff members. So look at the staffing difference here. In North Dakota, we have 8 attorneys for both houses. And we have, you know, the staffing for the fiscal staff is 9 on it. And what they do in Washington is when the bill is introduced, it's referred to committee, when the bill is scheduled for a hearing, so not all bills receive a hearing in Washington, that's when the committee staff prepares the bill analysis. And the bill analysis is given to when the hearing starts on that bill. So it's the first thing that's said is the staff will give the bill analysis for a bill before sponsor anybody else. And that's the only time a bill analysis is prepared. And then when, as the bill proceeds through the process, then they do a bill report, which includes summaries of testimony, the majority report, the minority report, the amendments, they include everything else. And the summary of the bill basically takes the analysis, but it revises it through the process. And if you want to look at the appendix, just I included two bill analyses from Washington. We have Appendix A, which is House Bill 1459. I don't know why they needed an analysis of this. It's kind of no-brainer. But if you're in a wine program, is it viticulture, enology? If you're under 21, you can't taste the wine if you're in a program to make wine. So this bill allows people between students between 18 and 21 to taste the wine within the program to make wine on it. That's what the bill does, and you can see what the bill analysis is here. It gives a background on it, and on page 2 it gives a summary of the bill and appropriation none and fiscal not requested. Easy. I mean, it's easy. Basically, it's the bill. We have the bill attached. The bill analysis is, you know, 2 pages. The bill is 3 pages. Basically, the bill is about 5 lines. The next one is House Bill 2030. And this is the point I want to make about the time it's taken. 2030 was the equivalent of their DUI law rewrite. The DUI, they had a DUI bill also, 80 pages on it. This is the bill analysis for that. It provides a brief summary of the bill. That's 2 pages. And it gives a background. The background has nothing to do with the bill. It gives a background of, if you look at it, the penalties for DUI, the sentencing scoring that they use, the community custody that they have, electronic home monitoring that they have, negligent driving and marijuana offenses, impaired driving offense of the child, goes through everything. Goes through, it's a background of 6 pages. It has nothing to do with the bill. It gives a background on it. And then they get into the summary of the bill, which is 4 pages long on it. And this type of bill summary could not be done in under, I'd say, at least 3 days. Because just looking at the background of all the penalties for that. And I want to point that out about the time taken. And remember, they have a staff of 5 people that do this, on it, just in the committee staff. So once we get past the Washington legislature, we look at the legislative council staff, back to the memo on page 5. We're authorized 37 positions. We have 8 attorneys in the legal division. Fiscal's got 9 fiscal positions. We look at the amendments. Because of the new technology, when we do amendments, basically we're doing drafts of bills. During the 2013 session, we did 3,600 drafts of bills and resolutions. Approximately 600 of those were appropriations measures. Again, every amendment requires a draft of a bill. In 2011, I know for sure that there was one bill that had over 90 amendments to it. Thank you, Tax Committee.
Any culprits in here?
So, there is. Yeah, well, I wasn't looking at them. There were 3,000 non-appropriation bills. Divide that among basically 7 drafters. That's over 400 bills that are drafted during a session. That's just bills on it. We also do memos and other research on it. The fiscal staff provides support to the Appropriations Committee. Presumably, any bill analysis would not need to be done for an appropriation bill. Appropriation bills shouldn't include too much substance of law. I said shouldn't. I didn't say that they don't on it. But they have statements of purpose of amendments, and they basically do an analysis when they do amendments on it. And we get to the last page, the feasibility of a pilot program. A true bill analysis needs to be done by an independent, nonpartisan staff, just like what they have in Washington. They have nonpartisan staff, they're independent, not subject to any influence by an individual legislator, caucus, or party. We're already requested to draft laws in certain ways. We've had legislators request us not to use certain words in the title of a bill because those are buzzwords and flag words. Don't use the word regulate because that just causes people concern. Think of something else to use, you know. So authorize is good. We authorize a lot of stuff on it. Or it relates, you know, provide for. But we requested revised language to obfuscate, to make it unclear as to what the impact of a bill does. We've been asked to do that because we don't want it too clear as to what's happening here on it. And we do that. I mean, we work for individual legislators. They do what they want. We're requested not to change any language in bills that have been prepared by outside sources. We can identify a couple of groups that we don't really want to touch their wording because it's kind of funny in the first place. And we just kind of see if the legislature adopts that. Sometimes you have on it. Polar bears can swim. We know that on it. But, similar pressure would be exerted, we think, on any bill analysis that's prepared. Don't identify any constitutional issues. We don't want that brought out. Don't identify this. You know, and the pressure's there on it. True bill analysis may identify issues not appreciated by some legislators. For example, a background may identify the effect of a bill on local side ordinances, which was a bill in the last session that related to local sign ordinances and preempting them because of a legislator's campaign. Extreme care would be required to us not inadvertently refer to a benefit, such as implementing the Affordable Care Act. Some people might not see that as a benefit. And if we happen to accidentally say that, that's going to cause some concern by some people on it. Imposing a local government mandate or in a manner that distresses opponents or supporters of a bill. Basically, we see that it could be an argument that this is death by bill analysis, just like it's death by fiscal note, which is used quite a bit on it. Finally, a bill analysis would need to be prepared by committee staff, people that are in the committee, so that we're sitting there in the limestone tower, so to speak, drafting legal bills for the attorneys. We're not in the committee to hear what the testimony is, to hear if there's problems with the bill. We're just looking at black and white letters on it. People come in and testify. That's why there's issues with bills, and that's why you do amendments. You find out that we need to modify some of this language in a bill to make it passable. The attorneys that, if we're not, anybody who's not sitting in a committee doesn't have that. But interns, I emphasize that interns are not qualified to do this. And I will give you an example that everybody is dead now except me on this. When I started working here, we did a bill summary in 1975, and I remember this because I laugh about it every once in a while. It was late at night, a bill came down, and it was the plane coordinate system in North Dakota. Establish a plane coordinate system. And I also was working on some amendments. I had to get this thing off here. I go, plane coordinate system, you got to be kidding me. What is this? I'm going, okay. I looked at the first section of the bill. Generally, this bill establishes a plane coordinate system in North Dakota. North Dakota is divided into regions, period. That's it. It's out of here. I thought the bill had to do with airplanes. I really did on it. It didn't have to do with airplanes. It had to do with geography on it. But that's the danger of doing something when you're not in the committee. And it's also the danger of putting that burden on an already overworked staff. And that completes the background information on the pilot project.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Holmberg.
Maybe Jay was the one that actually drafted it, but a few sessions ago, there was going to be an international tournament at UND. And it was going to start on Christmas Day. And, of course, all the international folks wanted booze. And you should read the language that the legislature passed. You can't find anything about what that particular section did, except it exempted such and such from such and such from such. It is absolutely classic. I think Martinson might have been involved.
But it was classical, you couldn't tell what that bill did.
Chairman, Senator Holmberg, Representative Martinson has some classic bills, let's put it that way.
Any discussion, any members? Representative Thorson, we'll allow you to say a couple words, being this is your idea.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Again, Representative Blair Thorson from District 44 in Fargo. And the reason I brought this forward was, as Mr. Bloomwood said, it's something which had come to my attention by some folks who I know and who'd worked in other states. And the reason I chose Washington was because I happen to know somebody who was on the staff there at one time. And I understood they have a much larger staff and a much more in-depth analysis of perhaps what we're doing. I guess my idea was to maybe instead of going into all of the deep details that we see in some of these examples, I look on Appendix B where it talks about House Bill 2030 in the Washington State House of Representatives where they do a brief summary of the bill. And that would be my idea of a limited bill analysis, just to maybe have some bullet points there and a contact number for somebody. If someone in the general public or another legislator wants to be able to reach out to find out more information. The fact is, we are a very limited legislature. We don't have individual staff like many states do where they do research. We rely on talking to people on the other committees about a bill as it comes to us. But I think this type of thing, especially not only within ourselves, but to the general public, would be helpful to some extent. And that's why during the conference committee, and I think Senator Holmberg, you were there, and Senator Carlisle and Representative Brandenburg and some others, we talked about this, you know, trying it maybe in one or two committees as a bill was being prepared, just to prepare some bullet points possibly, and put it out there on the web for people to take a look at and to have an opportunity to kind of get an idea. Another example is I talk to people on policy committees who really are not knowledgeable so much as we are on appropriations as to how we go ahead and get information, and I show them the green sheets. And a lot of people who don't serve on appropriations say, wow, I didn't know this was there. It kind of breaks down the fiscal impact of what we're doing in each bill on a two-page sheet. And this is kind of what I'm thinking in this area. I know certainly other states, I looked at what Florida does, they have each bill is about that thick. I think they do a background on whether this limits individual liberties, whether it's bad for business. I mean, there's some pretty pejorative things in there I think you could probably agree with. But I would think that going forward, we take a look at doing something where there is just maybe a few bullet points, try it, see what we can get, and I think it would help not only ourselves but the general public get a better sense of what it is we're doing on certain bills, and hopefully at some point we could expand it. And, you know, I guess staff-wise, I realize we put the staff through a lot during the session. It is a burden, and I'm not certain that, you know, I know you say interns might not be the best for this. I still think there might be some room to prepare bullet points, but I guess that's all I have. I would just hope that, you know, we talk about death by fiscal note, and we don't want to have that with the bill analysis or memorandum or anything else. But anyway, it's just an idea. Take it as you wish and do what you wish with it. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any members, any questions? Thank you, Representative Thorson. Comments? Anybody have an interest in trying it in one committee and see how it works on a limited basis on a brief summary?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Austin.
I see the problem that, let's say we go ahead and run it in one committee. Depending on the committee as such, it might work out that those particular bills were rather easy. And so you take that assumption that this is going to be an easy process for all committees and all bills. I would rather see that we're going to make an assumption that, you know, this is really a good deal and this could really work out. I think a lot of our current summaries and so on really come from the bill sponsors themselves in their own hearing process and what that, and if you want a summary, whoever that bill carrier is and what their response is in hearing. That should be an attachment to that if you really want to know more about the bills. The bill carrier himself, his explanation, and so on. So it seems to me it'll be, it's really going to drag us out, and it probably is adopted. Maybe a good thing, we probably only have 100 bills in the whole session because of the time, but that's my concern, Mr. Chairman.
Any other thoughts?
Mr. Mark? Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and maybe this is a, I don't know if it's a solution, because actually I'll say, Representative Thorson, I agree with many of the points, and I think an analysis would be most helpful. Sitting on any committee or attending any committee hearing that you have no background experience in, some of the jargon alone can leave you scratching your head at times, going, you know, trying to keep up with what is the purpose of the bill before you. But maybe to Jay, is there a movement in the works to make the testimony from a committee hearing available digitally before the session, before the bill comes to the floor? Or, you know, what would the time frame be from having the testimony presented at the initial bill's hearing be in order to be available for the public for public consumption? Is there a more expedited time frame that would allow testimony to be used as kind of a dissemination of the bill before you?
I say, Mr. Chairman and Representative Mock, are you talking about just a recording of the hearing or the minutes done by the committee clerk? Because then the committee clerk's workload would depend on when the bill would come to the floor.
Right.
Again, anything that you're imposing before you vote on the bill is going to slow the process down.
Right. Mr. Chairman and Jay, I guess my thought is, you know, I know after the you know, once the session has adjourned, sine die, we can go on to the legislative library, the history, we can look up any bill number and see all of the documents that were presented to throughout the process, every committee, every conference committee, and that's the testimony along with the minutes. What I'm thinking, if there's testimony submitted, and I know many other states, they require any testimony provided by presented to a committee, they request those remarks prepared and given to the committee chaired and to the clerk so that they don't have to transcribe everything. If there are documents provided at a hearing, could that be scanned and made available in a faster fashion as opposed to waiting to the end of the session?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mock, just to give you an example, the legislative history of bills from the last session, I think it was just put on our web page probably within the last month, and I think you know that takes the time to straighten everything out to make sure that everything is there on it. That's taking 8 months to move something, you know, move it down to a day on it. So if you put anything on there without it being reviewed and assured that it's complete and adequate and correct, it's dangerous.
Senator Ackerman.
Mr. Chairman, I guess when I look at this and it says a brief summary of the bill is done by a nonpartisan legislative staff, I don't know why the sponsor of the bill couldn't do that. Because you know that a bill, whether it's the legislative staff, all you need to do is, if Senator Flacco sponsors a bill for education, lists two or three bullet points. This bill does this, this, or this. And the sponsor of the bill could do that, and then it could be ready without having someone else do that.
I guarantee it wouldn't be nonpartisan.
Well, no, I know it wouldn't, but a bill isn't nonpartisan anyhow.
Yeah, I understand what your point is. Because obviously that sponsor is going to go into the testimony to defend whatever he wants to have done in that particular bill. But whether or not they would be willing to take the time frame to do that, it might. And I'm as Representative Austin, it might keep the number of bills he introduced down a little bit.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Heckerman, I can respond to that. You may say the sponsor will do that, but I can predict that it'll be the legislative council staff that'll be doing that for the sponsor.
Well, you could hold the bill could be held until it's done. I mean, it doesn't have to, you know. I mean, you can put rules on that.
Any other discussion before we move on here? Representative Devlin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I agree with Representative Thorson, and I like the idea. I just don't know how to get there. I mean, I don't want to just bury this idea. I hope it'll
you know, there may be this approach used in another state that we can look at as we move along or something, so let's, you know, let's just keep the topic out there. Let's not completely walk away from it, because I think it has great value. It's just how to get there without adding 25 new people in legislative council or whatever, but it, the idea itself is worth for future consideration.
Any other thoughts? When Senator Holmberg fell with his nose, we're going to... He sat in on this particular conference committee. Any comments? No. Okay. We'll leave this on the agenda for the next time, and if any brilliant ideas come up, we will pass them forward at that point in time. Next on the agenda is the Mr. Smith going to talk about the status of the library renovations.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, yes, we have a one-page summary. Just want to update the committee on the project that you approved back in September. Just kind of a refresh is what we're doing in that project. We're going to remodel the existing Senate clerk area into our new library space. We're going to remodel the existing library space into 6 professional offices. And we replace the existing stairwell that goes up to the third floor above the library, which is the IT area, and that's really a safety issue. Project would demolish and reconstruct approximately 2,900 square feet, a little bit more of that with the hallways and that kind of thing. Construction actually began on Monday. It's scheduled to be completed, I'm saying July 1st. The contractors are saying July 11th, so hopefully they can make up some time along the way. As I indicated, the LPNA approved that back in September. Since then, what we've done is we've hired an architect. It's required by law. We hired J2 Studio in Bismarck. They developed detailed plans for the area, and it was determined additional steel beam structural supports necessary to handle the weight in the new library area, the floor support. And then the steel stairwell was redesigned, and it now includes 3 tiers and a new landing up to the IT area. The next part deals with the bids that we received in January. They were more than what we expected, more than what the architect expected, except for the electrical contract bid, which was actually lower than expected. And you can see what the bids there. We have the architect's estimate and then the low to high bids. The total of the low bids was $331,654. That works out to about $114 per square foot for a remodel. The general contractor bid was $206,000. That was Straightway Construction in Bismarck. The mechanical contract bid was for $92,900. That was Central Mechanical in Mandan. And the electrical bid was Mirror Electric in Minot. Once we received the bids, we met with the architects and the engineers that were involved and tried to get some understanding of why the bids were as high as they were. In the general construction area, some of the reasons for the higher bids were the structural steel, the additional work relating to that, the demolition of stairs and shelving in the library area, the access to that second floor area through the that west elevator, some of the other things, walnut doors, but that matches what's throughout the Capitol, and then local materials and labor costs have increased, you know, around 10% in the last 6 months is what we're told. The mechanical construction, some of the issues there were the automatic temperature control, high efficiency heat pumps, which matches what's throughout the Capitol, testing and that kind of thing, and then the electrical was really determined to be acceptable. And we determined collectively that with the current construction climate, a rebidding would probably not result in lower bids, and actually would run the risk of some of these companies not bidding because we'd be in the summer construction area with that delay. So at that time, I consulted with the Chairman Carlson, Chairman of this committee, as well as Senator Holmberg, Chairman of Legislative Management, and it was determined to proceed with the project based on those lowest bids. We've signed contracts to that effect, and as I indicated, they began construction this past Monday. And basically, the project was determined to make the best use of that limited legislative space that we do have. It would accommodate the professional staff office needs that we do need, and address the stairwell safety needs in that library area. There really was no opportunity to scale back the project, and any delay would probably just result in additional costs if we were to do it down the road. And finally, you know, we do have carryover funds that are going to be adequate to fund the project going forward, so, Mr. Chairman, with that, it's pretty much an update. The construction has started, it should be completed, like I say, in July. The only other point to make again is, you know, the Senate Clerk area will be moved, it'll be moved to the west side of that suite. That's actually better space. The only concern might be the access to the elevator, it's a little bit farther, but it is better space than what they currently, or had during the 2013 session, so. With that, Mr. Chairman, take any questions?
Just a question again, what was our carryover amount, and what does this leave us with?
Mr. Chairman, maybe Alan can help. I think, I just looked at that this morning, I think we have about $1.4 million. Now, this is the Legislative Council only. I should point out, we're not using Legislative Assembly money, that's a separate budget, and that has carryover as well, and we're not using any of the Legislative Wing Improvement money that's been funded separately, the $500,000, and there's some carryover there. So we're not using any of that money. This is Legislative Council money, and the reason for the carryover would be several things. One is we had some staff turnover vacancies that rolled up some money. There's some consulting money in the IT area and that kind of thing that we didn't do that saved some money. And then a big item is the committee, the savings from interim committees, where we hold joint meetings and that kind of thing, that realizes some substantial budget savings as well. So those are kind of the key components that drive that carryover money.
Okay. Any questions, committee members? We do not need any action on this, it's just to report on what's going on.
Right. And hopefully as we get down the road that we can have the committee walk through that space when it's a little more complete and see what's actually taking place.
Okay. I want you to know, Senator Schneider, that in your absence we considered you present.
Thank you,
Your Honor. You've been in court too long.
Yeah.
That's pretty funny. You don't get called out very often. You hush. All right, next on the agenda, Mr. Steckler, you're going to give us an update on what's happening in the audio replacement projects and electronic travel requests, whatever that is. We're going to let you give us a little report.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Jason Steckler, Administrative Services Director for the Legislative Council. As you know, this committee in September previously approved the replacement of the House and Senate Chamber audio systems. We have completed the design with that. We've ordered a lot of the equipment, but there are two remaining decisions that this committee can very easily take up today. And for that, I'm going to let Kyle Forrester actually brief you on those two remaining decisions so we can drive on with the project.
These guys got it all figured out. It'll take me 20 minutes to get it
out. Notice they still have it on paper.
Yeah. Well, they don't trust us.
Okay, I'm Kyle Forrester. I'm the IT manager for Legislative Council. And as Jason said, I got a presentation to go through. The sound system was approved at your meeting on September 25th. We have two things for you to consider today: the speaker location in both chambers and member microphone replacement. Currently, the speakers in both chambers are on the ceilings, so the sound is directing down on top of your heads. Currently, sound quality is an issue throughout both chambers, particularly in the rear of the floor where the members sit and underneath the balcony and up above in the balcony. To get good quality sound, you need sound that's, it's almost like line of sight. Wherever your speakers are, you want that sound to be able to get to your ears. So if there's something inhibiting that path, then you're going to have sound quality issues. In the Senate chamber, there's two options. Okay, we've got the ceiling speakers today. The other option would be to put speakers on the front walls of both chambers. In the Senate chambers, locating speakers on the front walls would significantly improve the sound in the rear of the chamber, underneath the balcony area, and up in the balcony. In the House chambers, the sound quality by placing speakers on the front would be improved throughout the whole chamber. Basically, our recommendation is to install the Rankin Heinz iconic steerable speaker arrays. These speakers would be mounted on the front of each chamber. The benefits, we'd have quality sound throughout the whole chamber. Members will hear a sound that is more natural because the sound is not coming down upon your heads. As you speak to somebody, it's kind of a direct face-to-face. The sound would be coming at you more in a horizontal fashion. The other thing that's with the speaker array that we're recommending is the sound can be electronically steered. So after the system is installed, if we needed to ever make a coverage change or a direction of the sound, we would be able to do that after the speakers are installed. Essentially what the speakers would look like, on the right-hand side there, because of the size of the chambers and the area of coverage that needed, the speakers come in modules. We would need a set of 3 modules. So the speakers themselves would be approximately 10 feet tall, and they're about 6 inches wide and 6 inches deep. So that would correlate to what you're seeing, that third array next to the one that has the covers off where it's showing all the speakers. So that's essentially what they would look like. Now, aesthetically, what would happen is the manufacturer would paint the frame and all the components of the outside of these speakers so they would blend in with the wall. So as you're looking at the speakers on the wall, they should just blend in. In the next 2 slides, I show what would it look like in the different chambers. So here's the house chamber, and you have this picture in your handout too. But I didn't mark it on the slides, but there essentially is 2 speakers, one on each side of the concave. So essentially right in here, there's a vertical speaker about 10 feet tall, and another one here about 10 feet tall. So that's how they would essentially, we graphically added that onto this image of the chambers. Here's what the Senate would look like. Again, they would be about 10 feet tall, and they'd be on the both sides of the concave of the upper rostrum. So they would be painted so they'd blend in with the woodwork. Now, because they have any speaker is going to have little open, small open slots so the sound can get through, essentially, so there will be some little bit of darker contrast in the color. So they're designed to blend in, and that's the way the manufacturer would deliver them to us.
Any questions on that part? We're not getting the used ones from the Senate, are we?
No. It would all be brand new sound systems, both chambers.
That's what happened to it last time. We were just checking to see if that wasn't going to happen this time. Good.
Any questions, comments? This was all part of the original bid that we did, correct?
Correct.
All right. Without any questions or concerns, we'll move on to the next part, unless you have any more on those.
That's it.
Okay.
Okay, the next part is that we would recommend installing new Audio-Technica gooseneck microphones on all the member desks. These are microphones that have a lighted mute switch, and I'll have a slide coming up here that shows a picture of them, and I do have a hand around microphone. Basically, sound quality is an issue in both chambers with the CB-type microphones. The gooseneck microphones are a more professional microphone. They would provide significantly better sound than you're going to get out of the CB-type squeeze-to-talk microphones that you have today. Basically, because they'll have a switch to tap to speak, so the members would still have control over turning on their mic and off. It's just a simple tap. It's not a push. It's just kind of a little sensor that detects that you touched it, and the mic will come on and off. And it's a lighted switch, so you will know if your mic is on or off. The other thing that's different currently with your CB microphones, to be heard, you actually got to hold that microphone right in front of your mouth to be able to be heard. Because if you bring it away, it doesn't pick up the sound very well. The gooseneck microphones are designed that you'd be able to hold the microphone at chest level, and you'd be able to move your head, move the microphone, and it's still going to pick up your voice and equalize your voice, and you still will be heard. And it will look very professional. So essentially, here's what the microphones look like. And I do have a handout that we can send around. You can actually touch it and feel it. Now this here bottom portion from the silver on down. That's just for demonstration purposes. You can see in the picture where you guys now have the wire holders that hold the current microphones. Those screws would come out. There's a little adapter, a black piece that would be put there, and then this part here would screw onto that. So then you would still, you would have your microphone that you can slide right in and hold it. Now, right now you're seeing some silver on here. Everything would be black at the member desk, so it looked very professional. This was demonstration. We couldn't get a black one right away, but when they would be installed, they would be black.
I don't know if I'm ready after all these years for a change. I kind of got used to the old TV, but there's no question we need to upgrade the quality of the product that's in there.
Give you ours.
I don't care who you are, that's funny. I'm checking now. Any comments, thoughts?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm curious. What you described was an omnidirectional microphone, so that it could pick up the sound rather than the unidirectional. He's nodding his head over here. So now I'm curious, as have you tested the feedback with the speakers facing the person talking and the feedback that could occur when I'm standing there holding it right here, talking, I'm facing the chair, and, you know, the sound's coming over the speakers back to the microphone. That has I'm just wondering if we've tested that.
We have Dallas Anderson here from Tricorn Technologies, and we asked about that. And because of the way the speakers are, there's a cone shape where it's picking it up. With the ceiling speakers, where they're coming down, we do get some feedback issues. But with the sound coming at the side of the microphone, that's least likely, less likely to cause a feedback issue.
And Representative Owens, I'm sure Dallas can talk to all the technology and whatever else, but obviously with the new components in the rack and the ability to adjust and control all the feedback, we're going to have less of an issue with that with the new technology. What's really kind of weird is you brought up unidirectional versus the Omni. We actually have more issues right now. I can tell you certain members, obviously for Representative Becker, where his desk was at and where the ceiling speakers are, even though he had a unidirectional microphone, the old CV, we constantly had feedback. You know, there's other members on the Senate that we deal with that, but then we try to turn the individual volume up and down because that's really all we have to control. But then somebody says, well, so-and-so's not loud enough. Then we turn them back up, then we get the feedback. So with new components, actually like in this room, this is electronically controlled as well. So it actually tries to adjust for the quiet talkers, the loud talkers. You have a speaker right above your omnidirectional microphone as well, and we don't really have the feedback.
Any comments, sir?
I just wanted to clarify.
You can just come to the podium, announce yourself, and then you have to make a comment for us there.
Dallas Anderson with Tricorn Audio System Design. Just a clarification, these mics are cardioid, so they are unidirectional, the new ones, as well as these. So it's a matter of this is the sphere of sound is picking up instead of this sphere of sound. Correct. So,
thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to clarify one more point. That means that based on what you just said, we'll no longer be able to put certain members in certain seats so we can't hear them?
Let that not be in the record.
I thought he was requesting a certain seat.
Yeah, he added a certain seat for his request. That's a good point.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, then I guess we have two actions for the committees. Looking for the approval to go ahead with locating the iconic speakers on the front wall of the chambers and then replace the microphones with the gooseneck microphone.
Okay.
So moved.
Before we take the motion, I have a Senator Snyder.
Mr. Chairman, just a quick technical question. Are these microphones capable of sitting on our desk and picking up the sound of our voice, or do we have to pick them up?
Yeah, so will they pick up from that distance?
You would need to pick these up, officer.
You would need to pick them up and hold them, but it would not need to be an inch away from your mouth. The idea is you can just hold at chest height, and it's a 4 to 8 inch pickup window is the ideal window.
You start waving that thing around. We have a motion by Representative Devlin. Is there a second? We have a second by Senator Snyder. Any further discussion? I think it's going to be a big improvement for what we're doing. We'll take a roll call vote.
Representatives Carlson.
Yes.
Devlin.
Yes.
Mock.
Yes.
Onstead.
Yes.
Rigusa.
Yes.
Senators Wardner.
Aye.
Sackel. Heckelman.
Yes.
Holmberg.
Aye.
Klein.
Aye.
Schneider.
Aye.
Motion carried, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah. All right, we have one more item. Thank you, gentlemen. Mr. Boyle, we're going to talk about the status of the following capital bond projects, and you're going to update us on what's going on.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
If you will, I have one more item underneath ours, electronic travel request form.
Well, I'm sorry. I thought I was moving rapidly.
And I promise to make this very, very quick. So, obviously, we all know how travel gets approved. Leaders actually give names to the legislative management chair. Those people request travel via the travel request form, and away we go. So what we've been asked for in the past is to try to make this a little bit easier and make it electronically. So what we're going to quickly go through here today is that process for travel improvement. We're not trying to change. Leaders still give that information to the LM chair, but they have the ability to fill this out either on their computer or on their iPad and actually send it into our office and to the legislative management chair, who then, when he sends it back out as approved, he can also include that particular legislator's leaders inside of his email. We have showed this to Senator Holmberg, and at his request, he just wanted this quickly briefed to the committee. We're not going to get into a lot of the details. We will actually send additional information to members as we institute this. We'll probably grab a select few that travel frequently and actually use it for a while, and then we will push this to your computers and to your iPads so this is available. So with that, I'm going to let Cody Molloy simply walk you through the two forms that you see on the screen and on your handouts.
Cody Molloy, Legislative Council Information Technology Specialist. I think that Jason did an excellent job at pretty much summarizing the entire process in the form itself, but I'll just really quickly explain. The existing form has been modified slightly just to allow for easier use on the electronic devices, and for as far as the technical side of things, Adobe Reader is the application which is required to use this. We would push this application out to legislator iPads that need it, and also would push out a link to the form to streamline that process. And pressing that email form button would submit this form electronically to legislative council staff, which handle the travel requests. And then Senator Holmberg, the chairman of legislative management, would be able to also electronically complete the filling out of this form and submit it back to legislative council. So overall, it's eliminating the process of mailing or scanning and emailing these forms, and should be much easier for use by the legislators. So,
any questions on this? I think, from my perspective, it's a good idea. But I can't tell you how many of those little things get sent back and forth and have to be signed, and I think it's a great idea. But so your idea is to have a test of this with several individuals and then get it in place and then move it on to the full assembly later. Okay. Any questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Last, now I can get to Mr. Boyle.
Thanks. Yes, Chairman Carlson, members, my name is John Boyle, Director of Facility Management. I'm here for the Capitol Grounds. I just made a quick little visual for everyone concerning some of the projects we have going on the Capitol Grounds, late winter, summer, into the fall. Cafeteria remodeling is the first one. You've probably noticed the cafeteria is closed, and we are still offering food service. It's up on the 18th floor. We closed the Tuesday after President's Day, so it's been about a month, and we have 88 seats upstairs. So far, everybody loves it. Sales have not been reduced near as much as they thought it would be, so the vendor's happy, the people that are using it are happy, there's nice views up there. Next one, the parking lot remodeling project, which is going to occur out here. As soon as the frost comes out of the ground, we're going to start that project. It'll be complete by mid-November. At the same time as the cafeteria,
I added this one, that corridor area is going to get redone to look exactly like the ground floor right outside of the harvest room here. It's the same floor surface, the same walls, the yellow travertine. The ceiling just won't be the same. And the reason we're doing that is because we're expanding the loading dock, so we keep all of that, you know, surplus property out of the hallways and into the loading dock area. So that affords us the opportunity to do that. And then last and probably the most important one is the brass restoration in the House and the Senate chambers. That work is going to be redone in between July and the end of October. We'll work with the groups that have the chambers already scheduled to be used, and we wanted to make sure we didn't start that until the project, Jason and those guys just went, the mics and all those are installed. So that's just a quick summary.
On that one,
yes, sir.
About 2 years ago, we had that all redone, the brass.
That is correct.
Are we paying twice for this little process now?
Mr. Chairman, no, we're not. The contractor, Capital City Construction, their subcontractor who did the work has basically flown the coop. He moved away from Minneapolis and kind of declared bankruptcy. The contractor, though, has told us that they're going to make good. So right now they're interviewing other firms that can do the work and schedule the time to come out here. And we've given them this time frame that they have to have it done by.
We'll not be paying twice for something we already have done.
I don't think so. I hope, well, I don't.
No.
I won't say.
That for me, yeah.
That's a comment, not a question. So. All right.
We're not planning on paying twice for the same work.
That is correct, sir. That is correct.
Any comments, questions? Thank you, Mr. Boyle.
Thank you.
Lady upstairs tells me he's never going to make it on time for the cafeteria, but that's, you know, the help. It's funny how everybody's got an opinion. Anything else? Any other business? Do we have an item on here for any other business? Anything else needs to be brought up? Administrative matters? Mr. Bringer, Mr. Smith?
June.
Mr. Steckler, anything further?
Not much. June meeting on June 25th.
June 25th would be our next meeting prior to budget section. We'd meet in the morning again. Comments? I have a motion to adjourn. I didn't have one. You're the motion.
Okay, I'm
all sorry. Now I have it. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
We adjourn. Well, we made it. It wasn't easy.